Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, helping product managers become product masters. Listen and get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad, your host. Okay, I'm going to admit it. I value the word value. I overuse it all the time. It's because I love the word. What do product managers and innovators create for customers? Value. How about organizations? They create value. What do customers want? The products they purchase must provide more value than other product options they have available to them. And how do product managers want to be seen by those that they work with? As someone who is valuable, again, creating value. Yes, value is central to product management and innovation. And it's also an important term to my guest who has explored various models of value. He is the author of the weekly Pivot Product Hits, a monthly newsletter for product managers on digital product strategy. And he's been a product manager creating digital products and services for over 15 years. And he's currently the managing director of Castle in the UK. His name is Paul Jackson. You'll find the show notes for this episode and a summary of the discussion with Paul and other valuable, there's that word again, valuable resources at theeverydayinnovator.com/122. Enjoy the discussion. Paul, thanks for joining the Everyday Innovators.
Thank you, Chad. Great to be here.
I'm glad to be talking with you. I have enjoyed your weekly newsletters that show up in my inbox.
Thank you.
For quite some time, in part because they're just very artistically styled. You have a nice design feel, you know, around them too.
Thank you. Well, we try. It probably takes up about 60% of the time I spend doing it. So I'm glad it's having the desired effect.
First time I saw them, I was quite envious. And I thought, oh, you know, I could try to do that with mine, because I sent out a little, you know, it's a weekly recap on Fridays on, you know, things I find around the net that are interesting. Not like what you do. But yours is just so pretty. And I thought, I can't take any more time than I'm already investing in things to accomplish this.
And you'd be absolutely right. You can kiss goodbye to large parts of your life if you do go that route. So it was one of those where once I'd started down the route, I couldn't go back. But it's certainly time consuming. And I'd love to say I have some smart automation that generates it, but it isn't. It's absolutely analog grunt work. So yes, I'm glad you appreciate it at least.
It is. It's very nice. And it's called Pivot.
That's right.
Can you share with listeners how that came about?
The name is nothing spectacularly original. At the time when I was beginning my blogging career, it was a few years ago now, and lean startup was still very much the new thing, exciting revolution in product. And I was looking for a Twitter handle that really captured what I thought was the essence of the exciting aspects and the countercultural aspects of software development and product at the time. And I chose Pivot as the moniker because it resonated without specifically stating product. So that was what I chose, and it was the beginning. It really marked the beginning of my introduction to the conversation around product management, having been an observer, a passive observer for many years before that.
And what was going on at the time that just got you interested in writing about product management?
Well, I had been a product manager for a number of years at that point. And previous to that, I'd spent about 10 years as a user experience designer. And I could sense that there was a huge, I suppose revolution is not an overly dramatic word, in product. And product management was going to become an enormous area of relevance and an extremely central role in the future. And I just felt that aspects of the experience, particularly regionally, because there weren't too many British bloggers at the time. There was really only the folks from Mind the Product, who are way, way ahead of the curve, and full credit to them, that were really representing product and the experience of product management from the UK. And I wanted to, I suppose, join that small club and represent a British angle on product management in terms of the conversation. I was also conscious that at the time I was a product manager in a large organization, and most of the and so somebody that was experiencing digital disruption within the corporate space and trying to get some of these concepts embedded within the overall culture. Mm-hmm. And the majority of product observation and product dialogue was absolutely coming out of the startup space at that point, or at least the big tech space. And I think certainly the original observations that formed the basis of my blogs was the experience of a product manager in a more corporate environment, trying to bring lean to, my earlier blogs were called things like From Mean to Lean, because it was about trying to adapt a large, fairly rigid corporate environment mm-hmm. to a fast moving lean startup approach and methodology, and all the all the anecdotes and experiences and conflicts that I'd experienced in the process. That's fairly standard now, but at the time it was quite unusual to hear that approach, because most sure. of product was very much from a engineering led culture like a Facebook or a Google.
Yeah, has taken its place in larger companies for sure, larger organizations, and still finding its tension points and how it fits in.
Absolutely.
And we could go down that path, but I'm curious about another topic I really want to focus on with you, because you wrote quite extensively on this earlier this year, and that's value. And I admit value is a word I probably overuse if I actually kept track of how many times it comes up in my daily language. Mm,
me too.
But I see value as being the heart of what we are about as product managers and what we're doing for customers. Because if we're not creating products that are creating value for them, and ideally more value than others are creating for them, then we're not serving our customers in any way that does anything good for them. So let's talk about, spend some time here talking about value. We should start out with the concept itself. So in your terms, how do you describe value?
Well, for me, value, as you mentioned, is super relevant. And the reason why it's relevant and will always be relevant within product, but is also, I think, overlooked in most product development conversations, is because it really talks to the fundamental challenges that we face as new, as product managers or anyone developing new products, which is that consumer choice and the decision environment around new product adoption is absolutely not rational. And I think there is still a misconception that the majority of product choices are very, very much based in a rational set of decisions, that you see a better product and you adopt it because you can see that it's a better choice in your life. And that's actually quite, from a psychological point of view, that's quite an outdated position, because ever since Daniel Kahneman and his behavioral economics revolution and publishing his findings, we've known that actually consumer decision and choice architecture and all of these fancy sounding words is extremely irrational. And rather than evaluate pros and cons in a very analytical manner, consumers and we as people actually are very irrational in our choices, and we make decisions based on a subjective view of losses and gains. And I think the constitution of value, which is obviously a very subjective concept, is very much grounded in those decisions that we make, which are irrational, but refracted through the lens of gains and losses, which Kahneman spoke about. And I think the reason why it's so interesting, as you say, is because it is fundamental to product adoption. And incidentally, that is becoming an ever more complex field, as the number of product choices that we have is exponentially increasing every single day. Hundreds of thousands of new apps every day, millions and millions every year. Countless numbers of new products are available every week and every month. And of course, there's far too much choice. And so the ability to understand what the mechanics are that inform consumer choice, I think is actually one of the greatest skills, the ninja skills that a product manager, particularly a developer of a new product, requires. So it's that intersection of technology and behavioral economics, which I think is really underpins the importance of value to product managers.
Which does suggest a bit of complexity in all of this. You know, when we look at any given product, there might be those features that we talk about with our friends. Well, this is why I bought it. But more likely, there are some deeper things that we are connecting to that we might not even want to voice. We might not truly be aware of them. But there's probably some external emotional elements that we would associate. Maybe some other things about, you know, really how this product makes us feel, or how it makes up for something that we have lost in the past. So let's get into the complexity a little bit here and talk through some of the elements of value. Mm-hmm. And in one of your blog posts, I'll put a link to this in the show notes too. It was called, it's at your website, product-value. You go into several models. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about some of the elements of value.
Sure. Well, like all artists, I steal liberally from great thinkers that, you know, I have the privilege to read and be aware of all the time. And interestingly enough, one of the most exciting new developments in this space was and is by a partner at Bain, the consulting company, called Eric Almquist. And he and his team have recently published, a number of months ago, the findings of a large body of research they did inside of organizations around how product value is understood, particularly in the context of pricing, and how organizations and companies price products, because obviously price and value are two axes that are very much closely related. And they have conceived this pyramid of value, which they themselves have stolen from Maslow's famous hierarchy of needs. And they came to the conclusion there are actually 30 elements of value that a product or service can deliver. And they stacked these in four layers. And at the bottom, you have functional, and then you have emotional, and then you have self-awareness or life-changing. And then right at the top, you have social impact. And like a pyramid, it skews, like any pyramid, it skews towards the base. So there's 14 elements, I think, just in the functional layer at the bottom, and then emotional, and then I think there's only two at the apex of the pyramid. And the point being, of course, that the majority of products and product decisions are made along very functional, utilitarian lines, you know, save money, save time, convenience, which are absolutely viable bases for good businesses. I mean, it's worked out very well for Amazon, and it's working out pretty well for Uber. So there's absolutely no shame in having a product that competes on functional levels only. But their research definitely indicated that there were bluer oceans to be explored by looking at what the elements of emotional value your product could provide, or even going higher into self-awareness and potentially social impact, but also that there were better margins in terms of profit margin by competing on those elements, because they drive greater degrees of long-term engagement. And Apple would probably be the best example of this. They compete very much on those emotional elements. They're never the most fully featured in terms of their products, and their marketing never talks to the utilitarian or the functional. Mm-hmm. It only ever it always talks to the emotional, and sometimes even the higher layers. And I think at the very least, I would encourage every founder, entrepreneur, and product manager to reference Almquist's pyramid and really evaluate what elements of value their product competes upon. The other interesting conclusion from his research was that even the best companies out there right now, and he referenced Amazon and Apple as the best examples, they only over-index, meaning they are only significantly better than the mean on about 8 or 9 elements. So success is not about being excellent at all 30 elements. That's impossible and ridiculously expensive. It's about being very very careful about which elements you want to compete upon and really focusing on those and accepting that you're going to be average at all of the others. So a good starting point for any startup or any product is to look at between 5 and 8 elements and think which ones they compete on and how.
I like the Apple example, or the app referring to Apple, and it made me think of the example of, I think this was last Christmas, several months ago, but there were some ads running, and I thought some of them were lazy, frankly. Some of the ads were bordering on being feature ads. This is how great the new, 7 Plus phone was at the time or something, right? In contrast to an ad that you might recall, I don't know if it was running there in the UK, right before Christmas time, where there's a teenager with his family visiting family, and he seems to be kind of tuned out. He's always just looking down on his mobile device, right? Like we might expect teenagers to do. And there's stuff going on, and his father's kind of, giving him the slightly dirty look like, why don't you engage and be part of the family? And then it comes time for the giving of the presents, and he presents this wonderful family video that he has shot in the last day of together and compiled on his smartphone, his iPhone, and it reveals the story of what you can do, right? It had such emotional impact. I thought it was so well done in terms of conveying the emotional elements of value in that pyramid. It was really effective. And then I frankly don't recall, in contrast, there was another commercial which felt lazy from Apple.
Yeah,
I only looked into it a little bit, and apparently the lazy one came from Apple internal marketing, and the really good emotionally connecting one came from their external agency. Yep. Regardless, the difference was what was surprising to me by being able to tie into the story elements and the deeper emotion. I had to have the new phone, right?
Yeah.
They said nothing about its features at all, not one time. It's just, wow, that's a moment I want to have with my family.
Yeah. And that's the essence of great sales and marketing. And I'm by no means an expert, but every product person has to have a good awareness and a good relationship with obviously product marketing as much as product management. And I think that then leads into another area, which certainly in London, in the product and startup scene in London is very popular and on generating a lot of interest right now, which is what I call the newest old theory in product, which is Clay Christensen's very well-known jobs to be done thinking, or I suppose paradigm, which has been bubbling under for 20 years now, but suddenly seems to be coming into its own. You've got Alan Clement, who's just written a fantastic book on jobs to be done, and very much applied within the product management space. He himself was a product manager. And Tony Allwick also releasing books all this year. So in the last few months, I think these are all actually 2016 publications. But very recently, you've had three heavyweight books all published on this on the jobs to be done theory, which has been bubbling in the background and probably more of an academic thing for a while. And because product has now become such a diverse and applied topic, it's really started to be embraced, certainly by the product community here in London. And the reason why it's relevant to what you just said is that jobs to be done thinking is all about focusing on the outcomes and the progress. It's very user-centered, which I would always endorse. And it really looks at how consumer choice around product is influenced by the notion of an outcome that you're trying to achieve in your life, a struggle that you've currently got in your life and that you're dissatisfied with an aspect of your life that you're trying to make a change to, and therefore you look around for products, and a concept of progress, so what the better life would look like with that product. And the thinking goes that the best products are those that have a deep understanding of that and align their product around the outcomes. So not looking at the features or the functionality, because that's not what ultimately consumers are looking for. They're looking for the better version of themselves. They're looking to make progress. And of course, I've always been a huge admirer of Steve Jobs. He's been a huge influence on me in terms of my product thinking, but he understood that implicitly, and he obviously was the prime mover behind all of the, you know, original Apple marketing and Apple positioning. And, you know, he always understood the outcomes and the progress and aligned Apple with that outlook. It was never about the specifics or the features. And so I think, you know, your observation is an indication, obviously, of the potentially the influence of him starting to wane as it becomes much more of a, Apple becomes a much more established company. They've done, I think, incredibly well considering their size and their success of maintaining their culture.
Right.
But, you know, ultimately with him no longer around and unimaginable economic pressures, I'm sure that over time things will may well become, because they are, of course, you know, the mainstream and the establishment these days, despite being conceived as a challenger brand. It's hard to really, it must be pretty hard to claim to be a challenger brand when you're the biggest company in the world.
Right. Yeah. The shine's gone a bit. And,
Yeah. I'm seeing that in the products. I mean, I don't want to get down that rabbit hole because we'll be here all day.
Yeah, right. It's definitely another story.
The dongle apocalypse, I'm finding it hard to forgive them for that, I've got to admit.
the story there for me is people have to recognize that Apple is kings at the design aspects of innovation, not necessarily technology itself, although they do bring new technology to market. That's not their forte. And Steve Jobs was just singularly unique. You know, I love the interview, and we're on a slight tangent. We'll get back to the topic in just a moment. But the last interview that was done with Bill Gates and Steve Jobs together, and
all things digital, wasn't it? Things D7, I think it was.
And they were friends, right? They were in this space early and pioneers, and they were friends and colleagues, and. The part of the interview when Bill Gates looks over at his friend and says, you know, the one thing I wish was to be able to predict the future as you can, you know, my poor paraphrase of what he shared, but Steve had a unique capability that you don't see too often at all. So
no, I agree. He could see around corners, as they say. He could see where things were going, not where they were, well, not where they are.
So on value, referencing these 30 elements organized in the pyramid is certainly really helpful, in part just because it, I think, broadens our perspective of value to even get our hands around that there's 30 elements of value that we can tap into. And also something you shared that was really important is that we don't have to excel across the board, right? You know, pick where you can. And as you said, the research they did indicates, you know, 8 to 9 areas.
Yeah,
and parity in the other places is fine. That's how you stand out.
Yeah,
I want to connect this to your experience too, and you're in the world of digital products. And when it comes to providing value to customers, we first have to know what dimensions are important to them. Mm-hmm. As you work with digital products, how do you discover what customers value?
I mean, it's a great question. It really talks to the fundamental challenge of new product developments, which is the difference between the push approach and the pull approach. And it's whether or not you start with the research and you start by understanding customer needs and then develop a product around it, or whether, as most startups that I work with and tech companies that I work with start, which is a founder with a big idea based on their own personal experience, decides to build a solution to a problem that they encounter every day. Mm-hmm. And so it's either... it's one or the other. Ordinarily, to get a product off the ground, you need an evangelist who has a passion for solving a particular problem or creating a better version of the world that they can envisage in their mind. But over time, the product team and certainly the product manager, through very, very close understanding and interaction with the customers and the users, I believe at the level of looking at outcomes and progress, particularly to inform the product roadmap, so they don't get caught up in feature creep, which is an inevitable challenge of being a product manager. I think that combination of the vision, the necessary vision of a founder to actually get that first product into the market, and then the very careful and close relationship that a product manager needs with the user base, asking the right questions, and then creating or developing the product according to that qualitative insight is absolutely key. I'm a huge fan of a very rich combination of both qualitative and quant insight. We live in a world of big data, and data is very sexy. But as a product person, I don't believe that without the quant is the what, and the qual is the why. And I think a product manager absolutely has to be constantly meshing the two together in a very intuitive manner in order to inform a real product roadmap. You can't simply do it with quantitative data. Mm-hmm. It has to be a combination of the two.
When it comes to being close to the customer, having real insights and having those interactions with the customer, how are you establishing that? How's that taking place? Is this social media forums? Are you meeting at the coffee shop and having discussions? How's that taking place?
A lot of it depends on the nature of your product and who you're serving. So the last product that I was hands-on operationally responsible for was called NewSmart. And we were based initially in New York, and then the product moved to London. The product team moved to London, which is where I spend most of my time. But we were selling into Asia. So this was an ed tech product. It was actually a venture with the Wall Street Journal. So we had access to their content, and we were adding a learning layer to their feeds and publishing it as an educational SaaS to Asian executives that were looking to improve their English. So it's a business English learning tool powered by the Wall Street Journal. And of course, in those situations, you've got large challenges of geography and cultural differences between yourself and the user base. Depending on the nature of your product, that's either a fairly normative challenge to people that are developing products with a large international reach, or a non-existent challenge for those developing products for their immediate environment. Certainly the traditional San Francisco methodology, where you're in a coffee shop and your users are the people in the local coffee shop, the people on the sidewalk, the people in the Uber, which is how a lot of products or typical products seem to have been developed in the Bay Area. Slightly different in Europe, where you're often serving markets that are further away or in different locales. Mm-hmm. So it's really a mixture of the two. But we were for a start, it's something that you can never do too much of, in my opinion, and you really should be utilizing every single possible channel that you can to get access to users and get access to customers, and have a mixture of face-to-face Skype conversations like the one we're having now, of running surveys across a wider base, of using tools like Qualaroo to be micro-serving customers consistently within the product. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge advocate of tools like Qualaroo to serve very, very focused questions that drive a higher level of response than a fairly over-engineered 30-question survey, which is always going to have a high attrition rate. Really just trying to combine that data and overlay it onto the quantitative data that you get from your analytics solutions to inform insights or to generate insights. Because for me, one of the most interesting aspects of product is asking users what they think of the product and how they're using that, and then comparing that against the actual data and trying to understand the delta. Because often there is, people will say, I love this product, I use it all the time, and the data tells a different story. And that then talks to what we were talking about earlier, which is the psychological perception of what people say versus what they actually do.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The scenario you laid out in that tool that you created, NewSmart, is a pretty challenging one culturally, right? Yes. Development team in the UK, audience has a completely different culture, different language issues.
Japan and Vietnam were our principal countries. So a very you know, very remote by, you know, from London where we were at the time.
Yeah. And I'm going to guess a product team that is not doing that work regularly, right? You do all kinds of digital products, but not necessarily under those cultural conditions.
Yeah.
How did you overcome that aspect? Did you have a cultural expert as part of the product team involved? How did you work through that?
We did. So there's absolutely, I mean, this was a B2B SaaS product. Mm-hmm. So there's absolutely no way that you can grow a B2B SaaS business without local people on the ground selling and selling into corporations. So we were able to leverage the firepower of the existing account access that Dow Jones already had mm-hmm. in those markets. So our principal channel to market was working with Dow Jones and Wall Street Journal account teams in Japan and Tokyo and Hong Kong and Seoul to sell into their existing accounts within the typical context of their sales calls. So we were really piggybacking off existing channels, which was, you know, part of the edge that we have. But absolutely, it absolutely necessitates a local on the ground knowledge, mm-hmm. both to inform the product, because otherwise you're developing a product really abstracted from the user base, and secondly to inform the messaging, the positioning, the articulation of what you're actually selling. So it's the classic dilemma of what people are buying is often not what you think you're selling, and then rapidly adapting to that. So we pivoted and adapted like any product team does to what the audience was telling us they wanted, and were able to really synthesize what, going back to the value concept, what the value actually was, and it ended up in a different place from where we started.
I assume you can share this. If you can't, you'll let me know. What was the core value statement in this B2B product? Because different thoughts are going through my head in terms of a business person in Hong Kong, maybe some sensitivities around wanting to learn English, but wanting that not to be known, and do it on your, I don't know. So tell us.
Yeah, you just hit the nail on the head right there. So the ideal user was a stressed out executive in Tokyo, mm-hmm. Probably with a 1.5 hour commute, right, on the Tokyo subway, and all of a sudden, and this was a big demographic change that we saw, which is almost completely hidden from people in the United States and the UK, who this doesn't affect. Obviously, there's a huge change occurring in Japan and across all of Asia, but Japan it's hit most hard, because they've been so insulated for so long, which is English becoming the language of business, the internal language of business. And to the extent that many, many enormous Japanese corporations like the Mitsubishis, like the Hondas, like the Bridgestones, have almost overnight, in the way that Japanese can tend to do, suddenly said, our internal language is English. And now all meetings and all correspondence and all communications in the company have to be conducted in English. And everybody has to have a TOEIC score of 800 by this time next year, or you're fired. And as you can imagine, that's driven a huge amount of chaos initially, but internal change in terms of the impact that it's had on the culture. And the biggest impact, of course, is on the more mature generation, shall we say, who are in the senior management and C-suite roles. And ironically, it's those individuals whose grasp of English is the worst, to almost non-existent. The younger generation have a much better grasp of it. And so all of a sudden, in what is a very hierarchical culture in Japan, where, it's very deferential, the senior teams and the C-suites are suddenly at risk of looking like idiots, for want of a better word, in front of their junior peers and their junior staff and their teams. And that's very, 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 very scary and very threatening to them. And the last thing they're going to do is sit in a class with people who are junior to them in the organization and clearly demonstrate an inferior capability in terms of their grasp of English. So the value that we were delivering them was the ability to, well, two things. One, it was to learn English at a level that they were interested at. We were using the latest business, financial, and technology news from the journal. So, you know, the latest developments in Bitcoin, the latest mergers, the latest developments around the, you know, the Snapchat IPO. So that was the basis of the content that we were using to teach. So it was of interest and relevance to them. But secondly, in a format, predominantly a mobile format, that allowed them to learn in their own time, around their own agenda, without anybody knowing about it. And so it was once we understood, because obviously when we started the product, we had no idea about that enormous transformation and that that business change and that need state. We learned that through customer development within Japan. Then we pivoted all of our marketing and all of our positioning and all of the product development around catering for those needs. So, you know, that hopefully is, it answers your question, but that was the story. And it was absolutely fascinating. I mean, I read books and books and books on the changing nature of Japanese culture and, you know, the historical resistance to adopting English and to anything from the outside, and, you know, the huge dissent from different companies around whether or not to embrace, you know, different modes of Western thinking versus stick to traditional Japanese methods, and you know, in the process, in order to inform, you know, what was ultimately a, you know, a product roadmap.
Really good story. I'm glad I asked and that you shared some details there, because we see value developing the more we get, the more information we get from the customer, the more understanding we have of what the real problem is. And we start to see some insights, which would have been known initially, right, without maybe just guessing, about sensitivities because of the power structure and these more senior executives. And you start peeling back some of these layers of the onion to get to what the real value statement is.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very emotional. It's fear-based and it's reputation-based. And even one of the clients I'm working with now, who are a B2B cybersecurity SaaS product, a huge use case and a huge driver for, I mean, it would be the CISO, the senior security officer or information security officer, who would be their ideal client. You know, a key use case is, don't make me look like an idiot in front of the CEO. You know, don't let the rest of the organization see data that makes me look like I'm not doing my job. You know, it's a fascinating combination of a very, very high technology, data culture, and an extremely basic human, you know, reaction to it. So at the end of the day, we can be as data driven and as quantitative as we want, but, you know, human desires, fear, and greed, you know, are still the drivers in the workplace. So for me, that is just one of the you know, it just demonstrates the richness of working in products, because you're constantly working at the interface of the irrationally human and the hyper-analytically, you know, the hyper-analytical and rational machines.
Appreciate all the information on value and the discussion, and I've enjoyed the discussion with you. There's so much more to follow up on, and I will point listeners in the show notes for this episode to a link to your article that you summarize some different value models, including the 30-element pyramid there from Eric Almquist.
Yeah.
It's time to kind of wrap things up. And I always like to ask for an innovation quote. And what is one that you are fond of, and why did you choose that one?
My my most cherished quote is a very short one, and one probably known to most everyone listening, which is, the journey is the reward. And I think one of the things that we've talked about in the past, Chad, is the advice that I would give to a young product manager starting out. And you know, serendipitously, the quotes and the advice are the same thing. You know, just remember, you know, don't just focus on the end point and the outcome. Enjoy it. The journey is the reward. And it's so easy to get lost or overlook the day to day in favor of the outcome that you're trying to achieve. And then, you know, it's the John Lennon quote, life is what happens while we're making other plans, right? And, you know, product management is one, such an incredible role to be in 2017. I personally wouldn't want to be in any other industry or field. And secondly, it's also one of the most desirable roles in 2017.
It is now. That has really changed.
You know, so many people want to be, will get into product, and, you know, there's a huge, you know, demand hugely outstrips supply. And so for those that are lucky enough to work in product, you know, just enjoy every moment of it, because it's a great time to be doing product. And you don't want to look back and think, wow, you know, I just didn't enjoy it at the time. And so for me, the journey is the reward is a great innovation quote, but also a great advice for life in general, particularly if you're fortunate enough, as I said, to work in product.
And it is great advice. And I don't know if you're aware of this or not, this podcast actually started out as in-person interviews I was doing on a year-long RV road trip with my family. So
I did not know that.
You know, the United States being a little bit larger than the UK, just a little bit. We got in the RV and we drove for 11,000 miles around the country and explored some. And along the way, I was interviewing people involved in product management and innovation and just really enjoyed that and missed it. Mm. Connection with your quote here, you might guess this, the most popular question we got of anywhere we stopped was, what was your favorite place?
Mm-hmm. Right? Of course.
And my family each had their answer, you know, the beach or Smoky Mountains in the Tennessee area. Mine was always the next one we go to because they were all great. And I loved the journey. It was the experience that I was buying into.
Yeah.
So not to get caught up in where you're headed. Enjoy the journey.
Definitely.
So great quote. Thanks for sharing that. Please let listeners know how to find your work and anything else that you want to wrap up with.
Sure. So pivot.uk.com is my blog. At Pivot Services is my Twitter handle. You can pretty much find all of my content and access all of my reposts through those two channels. You know, always keen to meet new folks. So please don't be shy and get in touch. Paul Jackson my current day job is at Castle. So if you're looking for me on LinkedIn, Paul Jackson Castle should bring me up.
And I'll add your LinkedIn profile to the show notes also so people can find that. Paul, thanks so much for taking time to talk.
Thank you so much, Chad. It's been a pleasure. And yeah, all the best.
Thanks for listening, and I hope you found the discussion of the elements of value to be truly valuable. If you don't have my Product Mastery Roadmap, another valuable resource for you, you'll find it in the same place where the show notes and the summary of the discussion with Paul is, and that's at theeverydayinnovator.com/122. Keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to The Everyday Innovator, which teaches product managers to become product masters. For more resources, please visit our blog at theeverydayinnovator.com.